Right.
Hi, hey. Hi, it's Chris.
There. Leave it to the Brit to figure it out.
Hello.
Hey, hello, Chris. Can you hear us, Chris?
I can, yeah.
Okay, and can you hear Sam?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yes. You can
hear, okay, and Paul?
I'm here.
Darth Atheist?
Everybody is loud and present, thanks.
Oh. Nope. Still there?
I'm still here, yes. Can you hear okay. me, though?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, well, welcome, Chris.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
And for you know, now that we're like 6 minutes into the recording, because we're hopefully Brian, who was unable to make this because of some scheduling conflict, will mercifully edit all the BS at the beginning of this out. Chris,
I think the truth is that it was just too complicated for Brian to do a four-way call.
I think so. And so now he said, "Oh, this will be a good opportunity to actually play with my kids." On a Sunday.
Just left
so,
us hang.
This Chris, which we've referenced already, and those of you who don't know who's going to be on the show, this is Christopher Munch, who has been kind enough to come on the show with us. And Chris, is as far as we know, is the first person to direct, and he wrote it, and I believe he produced it, or at least co-produced it, a film showing what many people believe is perhaps the most realistic in relation to what Sasquatches are actually like, and there's and, you know, they aren't being treated as a furry pet, and there is no explosions or the army doesn't have to be called in at any point in Chris's movie, and it's called The Letters from the Big Man. And welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I guess we should. And is it okay? I've suddenly I'm channeling Brian now. Is that okay, guy? Is that okay if I'm?
That's fine know? By me.
Somebody okay, needs to.
Yeah. So yeah, Chris, why don't you start off by letting our listeners know kind of a brief synopsis of the film?
Okay. Let's see. The storyline involves a woman played by Lily Rabe, who is a former Forest Service hydrologist who quit to pursue her career as an artist, which didn't really go anywhere. And at the time the story begins, she accepts a contract to conduct a stream survey in a watershed that had recently been burnt. And in the course of doing this, she realizes that she's being followed by a presence that won't reveal itself at first. And she becomes very suspicious of who that might be, but at the same time almost feels a certain sense of coming home or a sense of wanting to explore this further. She meets a guy, a human guy, also while she's on this trip, and she later reconnects with him. And the visitation from this unknown presence, who turns out to be the big man, escalates, and she finds herself having insights that she writes down, very vivid dreams, seemingly some sort of telepathic connection with this guy, which is not something that she, you know, necessarily understands or fully embraces at first, but it's there. And so she eventually becomes, you know, very protective of him. And I don't know, I suppose I shouldn't tell the whole storyline, but that's the setup.
Yeah, and, no, I think that was well, and I almost let it out of the bag that she kills him with a grenade at the end. But I, it's I like the film. I think Paul and Sam, you've seen it, correct?
Yes. I watched it last night.
Yeah, I watched it over the course of about 4 days. I'm afraid I couldn't sit down in one go and watch it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think the one negative is that it is a 4 day long film, and I would recommend some editing on it. No, it's about an hour and a half, and I saw it as well. And I think it is definitely a good film. And you know, obviously, folks interested in who are listening to the show obviously have some degree of interest in Bigfoot, and I would strongly recommend it because I think this film will be looked back on as, you know, really it was the first one to kind of take a realistic view based on what the sightings that have happened over, you know, how many recorded sightings over hundreds of years. And again, assuming Sasquatches exist, which
are you sure trying to make the argument that Harry and the Hendersons wasn't an evidence based docudrama?
No, it just occurred to me 2 years ago that it wasn't a documentary. So I'm a little slow on the uptake.
But what's wonderful about Harry and the Hendersons is it really served to kind of diffuse this monster stereotype. And, yes. And I think a lot of people responded emotionally to the film, a lot of kids in particular. But it's a very highly thought of movie, which is wonderful,
yes.
You know.
Well, yes. And it's fair to say that there have been movies since that have sort of looked at things from a kid's point of view, that the Little Bigfoot and Bigfoot Encounters and all sorts of things. But they've not – none of them have really channeled – Harry and the Hendersons in any way, in that they just haven't appealed in the same way that Harry did.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I think they did a great job in Harry and the Hendersons as far as the basic size based on sighting reports. It's the facial mannerisms where I think they got a little we really want this to be G-rated, so you know, make him look like he's missing a lot of chromosomes, or I don't know, just that was my, but you're right, I agree, I think it is a good film, and that is a really important point. It literally, as far as within the context of cinema, single-handedly offered another dimension to what Bigfoot was. I mean, it was pretty much, a marauding, mysterious killer before. I think it was 1986, 1987 it came out. And then it went almost to the full other extreme by presenting this big, lovable teddy bear.
Of course, for the last 5 years, the Sci-Fi Channel's been trying to swing it back the other way. with as much crappy CGI as possible.
Yes, thank you.
I saw a tagline for a forthcoming movie that said something putting the putting the fear back in Bigfoot, or putting the I forget what the tagline was, but it was something to the effect of, where have all the good monster movies gone?
Yeah, that's
not to sci-fi. That would be the answer.
So, Chris, what sparked your interest? A, generally in Bigfoot, and B, to want to take the time to write and then direct a film where it's the main subject matter.
Right. Well, let's see. Prior to 2005, I mean, my knowledge of the subject was pretty limited to what I had seen as a child, seeing the Patterson-Gimlin film and seeing seeing the 1977 film called Sasquatch, that kind of pseudo documentary that was made in British Columbia, which I found really interesting at the time, and I still find it interesting going back and looking at it. But my knowledge was limited, and literally this thing kind of just showed up on my doorstep. Not a Sasquatch, but the story came to me, and you know, I've done four other features in the past, and again, the subject matters are sort of all over the map, and these things also kind of came to me inexplicably. I don't know, but what I can say is that once I undertook a project, you know, I never really regretted doing it, and I always relished the opportunity to spend an extended period of time, you know, researching and making. Usually a lot of that time is spent unsuccessfully trying to raise money to make it, but it's a period of time that allows the ideas to distill down, you know, into something that's filmable, because of necessity, even a feature-length film, you can't put everything into it, so it always necessitates walking down a lot of paths that don't pan out, you know, knocking on doors that don't really hold anything for the story, but nevertheless, they kind of have to be explored. So in this case, I guess I became smitten, and another event was occurring at the same time that I found very compelling, and that was in a particular region of southern Oregon. There had been a big wildfire a couple of years previously that became known as the Biscuit Fire, and there was a salvage operation taking place on the federal lands that were burnt by it. And it became very controversial and kind of divisive of the community in 2004 and 2005, when I sort of started hanging out up there and seeing what was going on. And it seemed like the idea of treating this kind of fantastic idea of, you know, the interaction between a woman and a Sasquatch in a realistic way against a somewhat realistic backdrop would be the best way to go about it. So I, you know, again, read a lot. The early drafts of the script.
I had a question.
Sure.
Scott kind of touched on this. This is not your mother's Bigfoot movie, undoubtedly.
No.
I mean, this is a very different...
Uh-oh. We may have lost... Yes, Sam
like
dropped
Sam
out.
Lost.
I'm here still.
I think I fell off there.
Oh, there
Am
you
I back? Yes.
You were overcome with emotion. That. It's okay.
but what I was asking, Chris, is, you know, when I watched the movie... It doesn't read as as necessarily a movie that was made with the Bigfoot enthusiast in mind. I mean, for me personally, and the way I explained it to my wife, I felt like I was watching a movie where the vehicle that moved the story along just happened to be a Sasquatch. When you were envisioning this and when you were starting to write it and direct it, Did you see it that way? I mean, did you see this as the Sasquatch being the pivotal issue, like it is in most Bigfoot related movies, or did you just see that more as a means of in capturing what the movie was all about?
Well, from the outset, it was always my intention to make something about the subject of Sasquatch. I didn't want to make something that was strictly preaching to the choir, so to speak. I mean, I did want it to have a somewhat wider audience, and tried to construct a story that included, you know, a sort of aborted romance between this young woman and this wilderness advocate that she meets. As I started to say, early drafts of the script included a lot more plotty scenes involving the Forest Service and, you know, their alleged association with this other agency that was trying to, you know, extract a Sasquatch from the forest. And the intrigue aspect was greater in those earlier drafts. But as time, you know, went on, I realized that what interested me most was the emotional journey of this one woman who admittedly is, you know, probably not typical, but nevertheless, her character kind of presented itself, you know, whole cloth, and I liked her and, you know, wanted to see where it went. So, you know, in answer to your question, no, I mean, it was my intention from the outset to try and deal with the subject of Sasquatch. I mean, having said that, you know, there obviously are a lot of anomalous things about the phenomenon that one can delve into to a greater degree, which might then sort of tip the film in another direction where, you know, it's completely unbelievable. So, you know, I did try to walk a tightrope when it came to suggesting that there were these anomalous aspects of Sasquatch. And, you know, I don't know how successful it is for you, but that was the intention, not to clobber people over the head, you know, with something paranormal or too far in the realm of science fiction.
Yeah, I thought you really I think you touched on a lot of aspects of the phenomena that would appeal. Well, beginning with whoever played the Sasquatch, I assume it was a guy. I thought it was, yeah, it was just, how do you cast that, by the way? I mean, you just like, give me your best gorilla or something, but I thought he was great. I mean, he was just so, I don't know. It just seemed very realistic to me, very not, you know, overly apey, and not overly mystical, just like believable in the sense of if there's these beings that are this big, it seems like the way he moved was just – it just kind of fit. It just seemed very realistic, matter of fact.
Now, the actor, I forget his name. He's but he's done a lot of motion capture work, hasn't he, for video games?
Yes. Well, Isaac Singleton is the actor's name, Isaac C. Singleton Jr. And I had met him through a director friend who used to be a child actor who had played with him in Tim Burton's movie of Planet of the Apes. He was in that film and had done a lot of suit work. And he had worked with the choreographer of that film, a guy named Terry Notary, who had conducted a sort of ape school and had given the actors hints about primate motion. And so Isaac had a fair amount of experience, not that we were, you know, intending to depict our character as an ape necessarily, but he did have some primate background as a result of this other film, and I think he's done other suit work as well.
Sure. He's obviously quite comfortable with his physical presence in this movie, and I'm wondering whether the movie has benefited from his motion capture work.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I'm very much indebted to Isaac because, you know, another actor who was not as experienced in suit work could be very claustrophobic in that outfit and, you know, not be able to really relax and concentrate on, you know, whatever he can do. And in our case, I mean, really his way of emoting was by way of his eyes, since that's really the only part of his real body that sticks out through all of the latex and hair. So we knew that that the eyes would hopefully be some sort of window into the soul of this Sasquatch. But Lee Romare, who was the makeup effects designer, worked very closely with him, and I think his philosophy was to try and work with Isaac's features as they naturally exist and to build on them in a way that whatever, you know, this special effects makeup is a sort of logical outgrowth of that, rather than, you know, taking somebody who looks nothing like what you're trying to do and you know, force the issue. So their collaboration, Lee with Isaac, I think was a really good one and resulted in this work. I mean, having said that, there were things, had we had a larger budget, that I would have liked to have done. I mean, I would have liked to have extended his arms more, you know, to suggest that aspect of their physiognomy, but it would have been very difficult for us to do that, you know, given our constraints. So
I'm quite happy. Bob Hieronymus. He'll give you some tips.
Okay.
You know, the thing I liked about the Sasquatch you had in this, the character of the Sasquatch was, it's the first one I can remember in any film, and again, it adds, I think, to the realism, that he actually has a gut, that there's like a kind of a male mountain gorilla gut. You know, usually you have the ones in the Lance Henriksen films who've been doing their ab workouts apparently just before filming. The lean, mean, you know, military-friendly Sasquatch. But I think that's what another thing that added to that, if, again, based on what people said they've seen over the years, that it just was another layer of, wow, well, I guess, yeah, that would make sense, you know. And while he lumbers quite a bit in it, I don't remember specifically, but there was always – you got the feeling that – and again, like what people say – has happened to them, that this being could move really quick if it needed to.
Well, there were a couple of scenes where, and I don't want to give too much of it away. There was one scene down by the river, and there's another scene near the cabin where it's exactly like Scott's describing. I mean, this is a big character, a big Sasquatch, but because of the terrain and its own movement, it's able to counteract that size and actually be very stealthy, and that comes across really well in the filming. And again, the guy doing the actual acting does a great job of conveying that that very subtle stealthiness that's so often reported.
Yeah, I mean it's depicted very much as being much like a bear in some ways, in that it looks sometimes big and clumsy, but you know, right, it can move when it wants to.
Right. Chris, you had mentioned earlier about, you know, the difficulty at times it is in getting funding for projects. I know that firsthand. And so as we don't forget this and don't let it go too long into the show without bringing it up, and I'd like to definitely bring it up later as well, another reason we wanted Chris on the show, besides just because it's, you know, it's a cool film and it obviously it's our topic here on our podcast. But Chris is attempting to do some DVD video distribution of the film, and so he has gone via Kickstarter, which I can speak highly of. Used this last year for my AT project. Awesome site. And so if you go to Kickstarter.com. Yeah, what's that? Squatchfilms.com. That's right. That's mine. Please. Enough of me. We'll get plenty of me later. But if you go to Kickstarter.com and just type in letters from the big man, you'll find Chris's site. And he's got the tiers there, you know, of how much you can give rewards. And I think at this point, why don't we do a tally right now? I know you're
just over $5,500.
Right. He's going for how much? Your goal is...
75. Yeah, and I've been so appreciative and really, really pleased with how well, you know, the film has done so far. So I mean, this particular movie, you know, we spent a year trying to sell it in a more conventional way and doing a more conventional distribution deal, and it didn't really work out, not as a reflection of the quality of the film, but just because of the market, you know, place being right. What it is right now. And the larger companies tend to just go with safer stuff, and this film, in a way, one of the difficulties.
Steven Spielberg calling right now, by the way.
One of the difficulties I had in trying to finance the movie is that it really didn't sort of fall into a familiar genre, you know, that we associate with this subject matter, and also there really weren't the sort of clear cut heroes and villains in the movie that I think Hollywood tends to look for. So, as it turns out, I'm very happy that you know, I'm pursuing the distribution of it in this kind of grassroots way, and it's an opportunity really to connect with the audience on a one-on-one basis. And I always feel that a film, you know, comes about at least partly because of the desire on the part of that audience for this type of movie, you know, and we as filmmakers kind of respond to that on some level, I think, and you know, we then bring whatever is our own particular voice. But fundamentally, I think we're working in the service of this audience that ultimately would like to see a film such as this. So anyway, through the end of... Go ahead.
It is an unusual movie. And I can see why it's difficult to get funding for it and distribution for it. Certainly, anybody that's interested in the subject will absolutely love it. I can't remember the last time. I don't think I've ever watched a Bigfoot-themed movie that I've enjoyed as much as this.
Thank you for saying that.
But it is a slightly unusual movie. It's not kind of what you expect when you start watching it. But it is very, very enjoyable. How do you feel when you see what are frankly piss poor, crappy Bigfoot movies getting funding and distribution, and you don't?
Well, I think it's.
Am I still Chris?
Being heard? Hello.
Yes.
My meter is modulating here, but I don't. Am I back?
Yes.
You are.
Yes.
We're all okay. Back. What dropped out, and what happened? Anyway, go ahead.
Let's see. I just wish that they wouldn't call these creatures Sasquatch, that's all, or Bigfoot. I wish that they would not appropriate that name for these monsters that they're depicting in their movies. You know, I mean, certainly there's always a market for a good horror film and so forth, but to represent that these are, you know, the hairy giants that live in the wilds of North America and other continents is just absurd. And there's so much good literature out there, you know, in the field. And seemingly these filmmakers have ignored it all.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to speak ill of anybody. And there actually have been, as you pointed out, some interesting, you know, films targeted to children on the subject. And indeed, that animated film from a couple of years ago with Bill Hurt playing the voice of the lead character was very interesting in its own way. You know, it was a bit out there, but very interesting in its own way. So I just wish that the depiction of them as bloodthirsty monsters would disappear.
You know, one thing that I'll say, I honestly would have been happy with an hour and a half of the scenery that you shot and the music that makes the background. I mean, the two were just gorgeous together, When you were out scouting locations, did you ever go to an area and say, wow, these woods look really squatchy? Yeah, this looks like a really squatchy area.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my as a result of undertaking this film, I mean, I spent a lot more time in wild areas than I had prior to that, you know, in my life. I mean, I'm originally from Southern California, so there aren't the same sorts of forests that we have in the Northwest. But during the course of preparing it, yes, I mean, I did visit a lot of places. I wasn't so much thinking in terms of something being squatchier than another place, but I guess I always assumed that those forests, you know, were inhabited.
Squatchy. And,
yeah.
good choice where you went.
Yes, yes, definitely.
I'd like to do a lot more traveling. I mean, I'm at the same time, I'm not a proponent of kind of barging in somewhere and you know, potentially ruining someone's dinner by showing up in the place where they live. And you know, what I've found to be a more sort of useful way is to sort of pick a kind of neutral location. In my case, you know, there were a couple of Forest Service rentals that were in pretty remote places, you know, formerly used as lookouts or cabins, you know, that would service these lookouts. And, you know, just kind of go there and hang out. And if anybody wanted to show up, they could. And I think that's a useful approach, you know, where you're not kind of I had an experience once where I was in in northeastern California, around Lassen, and you know, they're famous for their lava tubes there. And this was in the summertime, where it had been suggested that, you know, some Sasquatch went to stay cool in these lava tubes. And I remember almost beginning to explore one of them and feeling a very strong sense, not a negative repulsive sort of sense, but a sense that, well, actually a voice said, you know, that's what national parks are for. And I kind of left because I realized that it would have been potentially intrusive, and I didn't want to do that.
Maybe it was a ranger living in one of the tubes.
That's right.
Crazy mountain man.
Exactly.
So, oh, go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say, there was a part in the movie that I thought was really poignant where the main character and another character, they're having a discussion about the impact on the Sasquatch, and she makes a point of saying they're making the corollary between the Sasquatch and the mountain gorillas, and she uses the example of Dian Fossey, and she says something to the effect that had it not been for Fossey, we might not have gorillas. Do you see the potential in your work and in other works that deal with the subject in a more positive light? Do you see them as having that potential to where they can reach out and sort of energize the populace and kind of turn people's opinions more favorably towards the subject and eventually, you know, doing something proactive to make sure that, you know, if they are out there, that they're going to stay out there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really have any illusions about this particular film having any kind of mass effect or any type of big effect. But even if it had only an effect on one person who might otherwise, you know, be inclined to do something really destructive or you know, hateful
like
towards them,
kill one for verification, perhaps.
I would be pleased. I mean, I think that. I hope that the film contributes in some small way to a larger body of work that's out there, and just a kind of shift, I think, away from the big game hunt mentality to a more reasonable approach to coexisting with the Sasquatch. I don't know that they need statutory protection necessarily. I mean, I don't know that there are any nefarious plots on the part of the timber industry or the government to, you know, keep their existence a mystery. But I do think that what they call into question is what they cause us to look at is the way we exist on the planet. You know, their existence causes us to, and any sort of confirmation of their existence causes us to look at how we live and how we live on this planet and how we use the resources and, you know, how we relate to one another, you know, how loving we are towards one another, how, you know, in our heads or in our heart we are. And I think The Mountain Gorilla certainly does that as well. You know, I mean, who can watch a film of Coco, the gorilla ambassador, and not right. be, you know, not see, you know, a tremendous intelligence in her eyes and, you know, a tremendous emotional quality as well. And I think that the Sasquatch, from what I've understood from various sources, I mean, they seem to be very emotional in that way as well, and seem to be pushing us in the direction of, you know, knowing our hearts and approaching them from a heart place more than from a head place.
Yeah, I mean, we've had discussions over the years. I think everybody interested in the subject has had the discussion over the years. You know, why are all the movies Lance Henriksen type Sci-Fi Channel monster movies, and why doesn't somebody do an intelligent movie about the creatures as we've learnt to understand them through sighting reports of these sort of gentle forest giants, and you know, this is that movie. Has it surprised you that you are that to date this is the only movie that portrays them in that light, other than Harry?
Well, again, I think some of the films like the Little Bigfoot 1 and 2 that you mentioned, and the legend, the animated Legend of Sasquatch with William Hurt and Harry and the Henderson, they all sort of contribute in some way to, I suppose, our expanding our thinking about the subject. I mean, one of my very favorites is the British Hammer film, The Abominable yeah. Snowman from the 50s. To me, that's a wonderful adventure story, but it's really not about the snowman. It's about you know, the relations among the scientists and the other people on the expedition. So it doesn't really illuminate them so much, but it does capture a sense of the great mystery that surrounds the mythology and their seeming presence there for a very long time. So I guess the preponderance of violent, unrealistic Sasquatch films is a reflection of you know, our tastes, I suppose, in entertainment, but which is too bad, you know, because I think from the outside, people who are not highly knowledgeable about this subject will immediately go to that sort of misrepresentation and think that it's accurate.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look in history before. Before mountain gorillas were verified, I think if you look, if I recall correctly, there was, you know, cartooning, which talked about, along with the speculation going on in various newspapers and perhaps even quite a few books, these drawings depicting gorillas as being these marauding things. And I think it just ties into that element of unknown of, well, we don't know for sure, even if these things, we don't have, you know, we don't have the body on the slab. So
right.
There is that part of everybody, more prevalent in Republicans than others, but, you know, to go toward the more fear-oriented, well, you know, damn it, we better protect ourselves now because these things could be plotting to take us over.
Well, and it certainly didn't help that they came from the Dark Continent, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So now I was going to also ask you, Chris – The film kind of – I enjoyed the film. I really liked the last bit of it, and I don't want to go into any specifics. But the last 20 minutes I thought just did a great job of I don't know, had a great sense of mystery about it and surprise to it, and I thought it was really cool. And it also kind of suggested, and I'm curious if this was your intent, that there could be a follow-up film to Letters from the Big Man.
Yes, I mean, I would really like to do that. I would really like to do that. And traditionally in the film business, the only reason that you make a sequel is to capitalize on the financial success of the first one. And in this case, there's been no financial success of the first one. So
right.
My doing a sequel would be strictly, you know, because I would like to do a sequel, which I would. I would not want to undertake it until I sort of knew more specifically what needs to happen, you know, to this character. I don't want to guess. I would like to either have a real life prototype that I could talk to and who's had this experience of that our protagonist has at the end. And there are certainly people out there. I mean, nobody quite like Sarah perhaps, but Yes, I do kind of feel that there may be a sequel in the offing somehow.
It's funny you mentioned that a real life protagonist, because when I was hiking on the AT this year, I met this young woman who was a curator or co-curator of a small zoo. And so my trail name is Squatch, and we started talking, and I, you know, as I am wont to do, start blathering on about Bigfoot. But she kind of initiated it, and before I even, you know, told her that I co-host a podcast and I made a couple films about it, she was dead serious talking to me that she wanted to be like the Dian Fossey of Sasquatchery. So,
oh, wow.
The odds were, you know, I could just randomly run into a young woman like that. That I think there's probably quite a few that are out there, and I think I've lost you guys again. We talked about this on the show before, that it's probably the ideal scenario.
Can you hear me still?
I was getting too anti-kill. I didn't even know we lost him.
I'm here still.
Yeah, I think Paul and I are the only ones that stayed on that time.
Hello?
Oh, no, Chris is back.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Paul, I see you.
I'm here. You see, this is why we need Brian's superior technology.
Right.
Obviously.
But it gives an edginess to the show, doesn't it?
It gives a raw, just rawness.
Exactly. It's very raw. This isn't a polished podcast. And we're richer for it. So, I don't know. Did you guys hear anything I said?
Unfortunately, I had to listen to the whole diatribe. I don't know if Chris caught all of it.
Just talking about that. I think, and it's going to increase too, and especially, you know, for those who see the film.
Call once more. I'm sorry.
What's that? Paul, is he there?
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. Is whoop? No, wait a minute. Chris is gone.
Oh, well, we don't really need to talk to him. We can just carry on about it.
Scott was doing a fine job just towing the show on his
young
shoulders.
Women of tomorrow. No, we so can one of you guys try to call? Oh, wait, here he is.
It's really trying to pick back up.
Hello.
If we ever needed a chance to look Bush League, this is it.
I mean, I honestly think with the amount of money we make from this podcast, that we ought to just fly all of us into one location every couple of weeks.
Exactly. Oh my, wait a minute.
And there he goes.
Lost Chris again. I think I
actually offered to do that for Monster Talk because Blake lives about an hour from my house. And so I could be like the Bigfoot show reporter behind enemy lines on the Skeptic broadcast. But I don't know that he's going to take me up on it.
Okay, there's Chris. He's back on.
Yeah, I think Brian should fund flights.
That would be good.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe Chris is having an internet issue.
Yeah, it's not like he's living off of spam and ramen either. I mean,
hello, hi, hello,
hi.
Yeah, hey,
hi,
hey. Sorry about that. I don't know what.
Thought the feds got to you.
No, I plugged it into a USB plug that I thought was going to be more reliable. Anyway, sorry about that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's our show. No, we were doing this is
You were
awesome.
Saying, Scott, about your zoo friend.
Oh, yeah. And I was just thinking, if I just happened stancedly, if in fact that's a word, ran into a young lady who didn't even know that I was that into Bigfoot, and she just – like she was serious wanting to be a Dian Fossey or a Jane Goodall of Sasquatchery, that there's got to be quite a bit of those young women out there. And I think, you know, a film like yours, I think, would actually inspire those who've either never had the idea or maybe it was just a little kernel of an idea. So I think actually there's going to be a lot of 25-year-old single women running around in the woods. So guys, get ready.
I thought there were already.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it would. I think that is the probable way of getting close. And hopefully, I mean, my hope is that doesn't lead to you know, potentially negative things like killing of the things or as – and I really like the way you did it in the film, the specific reason. And I'm not going to – I won't reveal it because I think it's kind of an interesting reveal in the film. But you have a very specific reason why a couple of the characters think the government is trying to study these things. And I liked how you picked that particular one because it just seemed to be one of the more plausible. As opposed just to his existence, which I think the Defense Department wouldn't really care about. But the specific reason you give, I think, was good.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are anecdotes out there about an interest on the part of the government in them. But I really didn't want to go down that road, you know, the conspiracy theory road too far.
Right.
Since obviously I did.
That's the sequel, man.
It will certainly be a part of the sequel, yeah.
I think what interested me about the film watching it was that during the course of the film, it kind of ticks a number of boxes of subjects that are discussed and associated with the creature without hamming it up. It isn't like you seem to start with a checklist, oh, must mention this, must mention this, must make them do this and this and this. There was a natural flow to it all, and it didn't feel the slightest bit preachy or that you've had to shoehorn in certain aspects of it. And it felt to me very much as if the film was more, very much more about Sarah's character and her loneliness and getting over her relationship and about the forest rather than the Sasquatch.
Right. Well, I'm glad that it worked that way for you. And I mean, one of the concerns that I had in writing the script and making the film was the idea of telescoping this relationship down to, you know, a period of months or weeks. And in reality, I think somebody in her situation would spend, you know, months, if not years, building this relationship, whatever it is. So I had a little bit of concern that it would seem a little too pat to have these events unfolding sequentially and in the course of a period of time that had a beginning and end really to it. So, but I'm glad that I'm glad that it worked for you.
I was just going to say, I noticed in the credits, you mentioned Robert Alley by name, who's the author of Raincoat Sasquatch. Who were some of the others, for the benefit of the audience, who were some of the others, the luminary, so to speak, or the Sasquatch researchers that you contacted prior to the film? Was there anyone in particular that had a lot of input other than Alley?
Well, Rob Alley was not a consultant on the film, but he did very generously allow me to reproduce two of his photographs, which were in his book. One of them was an inverted snag in British Columbia, and also a twist off. And these were used in the scene that were supposed to represent Barney's photography. So that was he wasn't involved apart from that. Tom Powell, however, the author of The Locals, was very much somebody that I turned to early on and throughout the production, actually. I had read his book and thought highly of it, and he was very generous in, you know, sharing some of his experiences, his methodology, which I think is quite sound, as well as introducing me to some of the others in his, you know, his circle of friends in Portland, who I also think are pretty good guys. So he was a consultant. Kiwani Lapsaritis was a consultant. You know, I realize he's a controversial figure in some ways, but I found him to be very reliable, and he also was very generous as far as sharing his experiences, and both of these guys, I think, always would, which I appreciate, would always, if they didn't know the answer to a question, they wouldn't pretend that they did. You know, they would always just say, I don't know, I have no idea. And those were the people I principally relied on. There were other people that I sort of met who were not researchers, so to speak, but who had presumed contact with presumed Sasquatch. And what else?
Tom Biscardi?
No, I haven't. I haven't run across Tom Biscardi.
Lucky.
Well, it. I think it's interesting because I mean, obviously, for people who are steeped in the game like we are, watching it, you definitely see those moments and those points where, you know, you're injecting activity or events that have been reported before. Or, you know, alleged activity from the Sasquatch that's familiar to us. But none of it comes across as being necessarily, I don't know, hokey. I mean, the way that the particular Sasquatch in the film is developed, what you see come from him seems very consistent and believable for that character. I mean, if that's what Sasquatch is, and Sasquatch is out there, and that's how they behave, and that's how they carry on, then the activity that you develop around him comes across as being very believable for that subject.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your response.
Yeah.
I thought another cool thing in the film, and when Chris and I talked on the phone a few days ago about the film and just Bigfoot in general, he had mentioned is that an early scene shows one of the characters is dropping or putting a book down, and the book is it's called The Klamath Knot. And for anybody out there who's never read this book, I strongly recommend it. It is not specifically Bigfoot related, but there is definitely ideas of Sasquatch talked about in it. And it's a very lyrical, but not hokey, kind of dense intellectually in a way too. There's a lot going on in that book. I go back to that book. Seems like every 2 years, and try to understand it a little more. I mean, there's cool, very easy to understand parts, and then all of a sudden it gets a little, it's a little murky. But then I seem to understand it a little bit better the next time I go back to it. But Chris, you had told me that in a way you kind of wanted that somewhat similar vibe of that book to be incorporated in the film. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I consciously set out to have that tone, but I did very much admire the book and found it to be just right on in terms of illuminating the mystery of that particular region of the Klamath Siskiyou Ika region, illuminating it in a kind of poetic way. And the way he speaks about possible Sasquatch in the area is quite compelling. I actually have a copy of it in front of me. I was going to try and just see if I had that quotation mark. There was one quote of his that I actually have it as
by the way. It's not with a K, not the Klamath, not like a Wayne's World
right.
punctuation.
Right, exactly. It's not as
it is
more
such a great. Yeah, it's such a great region because as he illustrates in the book as well, it's an area where geographically, botanically, biologically, things have really mashed together up there, hence the term knot, that it's all – if you look at shots, like geographic shots of that particular area, you can see how things have collided and have created a really relatively unique ecosystem up there. And, of course, that helps feed right into the whole mystery of Sasquatch as well. So I agree completely. I love that area. It is really cool. And in fact, I wanted to ask you, Chris, you had mentioned earlier that you had been up to a couple of fire lookouts up there in that general area. By any chance, was one of them Bear Basin Butte?
No, I've never been to that one, but it sounds good.
Awesome. It's like 30 miles from the coast, and I've been there twice. And you actually see it a little bit when you watch Squatching. I sent a copy of to Chris, Squatching. Available at squatchfilms.com. Anyway.
Hello?
Hello.
Just the translucent light of Arcata and Eureka just underneath the fog on, I think, most of the nights, because at some point there's usually some kind of fog coming in. Anyway, Bear Basin Butte, great place. I know it used to be like $50 a night, but it's probably gone up to that. But if you're ever up there, you get the whole mountain to yourself. By the way. So you get to...
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. The place...
We've lost Scott, I think.
I guess we lost Scott, yeah.
But it's all right. Nobody was listening to him anyway.
Oh. It was clearly the wrong person to put in charge.
Paul, I think you're actually hanging up when I start rambling. Is that what's going on?
If only I thought of doing that.
I was going to say, Scott, the main location for Letters from the Big Man was a Forest Service rental that about the same distance from the coast as Bear Basin Butte. So that's I found it a particularly interesting sort of transitional zone from the coastal range into, you know, the drier sort of Kalmyopsis wilderness area.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I found this quote of Wallace, if you'd like me to take a second and read it.
Sure.
He says, "If such creatures exist, there is a certain logic to their existence. Civilization has explored the oceans, the ice caps, the moon, but it has not adequately explored the human consciousness. We may be able to predict the fate of the universe, but our own behavior continues to surprise us. So what wild animal would be hardest for us to discover? An animal very much like ourselves, perhaps. Certain Amazonian and Philippine tribes were not found until long after their regions had been explored. Such wild animals couldn't be too much like humans." Hello?
Wait a minute.
Am I lost again?
No, I can
hear you. Scott's just struggling.
Oh.
Guess I'm...
No, we've lost Scott again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, please continue in Scott's absence.
Yeah,
I'm really
here.
Enjoying
Sorry.
The quote.
I think it's what I called in here, and it, yeah, go ahead.
Such wild animals couldn't be too much like humans. If they were, they would betray their presence by competing for the same habitat. Could an animal be enough like us to escape our endless snooping, yet enough unlike us to escape our endless competitiveness? It seems a riddle for the Sphinx. The forest's impression of evolutionary maturity comes to mind here. What if another hominid species had emotionally outgrown Homo sapiens, had not evolved the greed, cruelty, vanity, and other childishness that seems to arise with our neotenic nature? What if that animal had come to understand the world well enough that it did not need to construct a civilization, a cultural sieve through which to strain perception? Such a creature would understand forests in ways we cannot. It would be able to inhabit them even more comfortably and inconspicuously than bears. There are places in the Klamath where such a harmony between forest and hominid is imaginable, where the sense of aloneness and strangeness turns into something else. Yeah. Wow. So that's kind of the tone. He talks about them later on as well, saying the Klamath giants have another trait extraordinary for a primate. They're fully nocturnal. Their eyes shine yellow, red, or green in a flashlight beam, indicating that they have a reflective tapetum behind the retina, as do wolves, bears, deer, indeed most mammals. But no known higher primate has eyes that glow in the dark. Gorillas build leaf nests in trees at night and are so reluctant to leave them in the darkness that they foul them with their
excrement. Ryan's got a lot of editing to do.
Okay. Anyway.
I had a question regarding, and it kind of ties into the quote that you were just reading. In listening to you talk, I really get the sense that the existence of the Sasquatch it's an issue that reverberates with you personally. How did your actors connect with the film and with the subject of the film? Were there any in particular that really really made that connection the way that you have, or were they just kind of, I guess, playing the part, for lack of a worse pun?
Well, I think Lily Rabe, the principal actress, approached her part more from the standpoint of seeing, you know, this woman as somebody who needs to, at least for the time being, leave civilization behind to a certain degree. And I think is wrestling with the idea of, well, is she going to go back to it? And what is there for her to go back to? She was not approaching it from the standpoint of, you know, my the same standpoint that I was approaching it from, which was of wanting to make a film about the Sasquatch phenomenon and to do so as truthfully as possible. But I think she found my my interest and my well, belief in them, for lack of a better word, to complement what she was doing in a constructive way. And I think most of the cast felt compelled by the subject matter, but no, you know, particular personal connection necessarily to it. But I was very happy with I was very happy with the people who finally wound up in the film, and I guess there are no accidents when it comes to that. Usually, yeah. Well, you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say,
you go ahead.
Her character, and I thought the character of was it Barney the logger?
Yeah.
I thought they both came across as very real people. I mean, you know, sometimes you watch a movie and an actor is trying to portray a certain type of person, and it comes across as a person acting like that person. But in their cases in particular, I mean, they really came across like these are the people. You know, if you met them in real life, if you met them out at a Starbucks or wherever, that's how they would act. And for me, it made it a lot more enjoyable watching them. And so it just kind of made me wonder how they connected with the subject.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's a big compliment to them, and you know, it speaks of their great skill, I think. And you know, certainly we had many discussions ahead of time, and we didn't have a sort of more formal rehearsal period, which I typically have on films, partly because, you know, some of the cast was from New York and someone's from LA, and there really wasn't the opportunity to all get together in a room ahead of time and read through the script and rehearse it. But when people showed up on location and were there in the physical environs, I think that very much, you know, helped them to do something, you know, realistic.
So when did you actually film this, Chris? Because obviously we started seeing talk of the film last year, and it was at last year's Sundance, wasn't it?
Yes. I shot it in the main unit was shot in the fall of 2009. And then I spent, you know, a year or so cutting it, did a few more pickup scenes. And the first showing was in 2011, in January at Sundance that year. So it's taken, you know, it's taken more than a year really for it to play out the film festivals and the few limited theatrical showings, which were necessary to kind of establish its reputation more. And it's just now, you know, making its way to home video and VOD.
Provided everybody that listens to this goes to Kickstarter.
It seems like it's heading in a good direction there, so I'm very optimistic about reaching the goal.
And lest anyone think that this is just a film made for people into Bigfoot, if you check at Chris's Kickstarter page, he has some nice snippets of various reviews. Roger Ebert apparently liked the film, and I'm always butcher her name, is Manola Dargis, who's like the one of, if not the main critic at the New York Times, called it lovely, delightfully idiosyncratic. The New Yorker, Richard Brody, a remarkable film. So it's not just, you know, oh, we're into Bigfoot. I mean, it's had some folks outside of that realm really take note of it. And so I'm suddenly feeling like Jerry Lewis now. Only 2 weeks to go, kids. We only need $2,000 more. I'm going to dance and take my teeth out. Anyway.
But it has to be said, while we are talking about the funding, that the Kickstarter pledges $25 gets you a copy of the movie on DVD.
Yes.
I mean, it not only helps fund the distribution of it, but you get a copy.
It gets you the movie. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think I would not feel comfortable, you know, going around asking people for money unless they were getting something in return. So, yes, they're definitely getting the DVD ahead of the rest of the world. I mean, before it, you know, has a street date for a general public release. And it will be very well manufactured and well authored and replicated, you know, at a at a good facility and all and that.
Bonus scenes. I just saw this. Bonus scenes. That's in $25 or more. So
yes, yes.
Yeah.
Whatever I took out of, you know, whatever was sacrificed from the final cut of the film for the sake of pacing will be back in there. And there's some interesting stuff, you know. Oftentimes when you're making a film, there is some perfectly good material that you just – you don't want to keep in it for the sake of pacing. You want to keep the thing moving. And so
you've left
the grenade scene in.
The what scene?
You've left the grenade scene in.
Yeah, yeah.
Just Sasquatch jumps on the grenade, saving young Lily's life at the end of the film. It's really awesome. Did it while you were filming this? Any unusual occurrences? You know, possible wood knocking, screams. Was Isaac ever worried that if he was walking around and there actually was a Sasquatch in the area and it was mating season that he might be in danger?
He might get mated.
You look around at this Bigfoot and he goes, check.
Let's see. During the actual production of it, no, there weren't any things like that. However, prior to the production, when I was out by myself in these places, yes, there were some very interesting experiences. I mean, most of them had to do with and weird, just very strange sounds. And there actually, one of the deleted scenes from the film is Sarah in her cabin writing in her journal, and all of a sudden she starts hearing these really unusual sounds, which are naturally occurring sounds there in the cabin, like the
whoops again.
Pounded together, but she realizes they're not.
Blast.
I'm here.
It's a record.
Yeah. Paul and I are apparently there.
It's intense when it comes to editing.
Hi. I didn't realize that we were I was talking there, and I how far did I get into what I was saying?
Well, what was really interesting
was – show over again.
Yeah, it was only cutting out right before you said the interesting parts about, you know, she's in the cabin and she hears
– Then it was gone.
She heard a few, you know, sounds that were taking place – sorry – sounded as if they were taking place there, but weren't. And she asked the guy, you know, what's going on? Is this some sort of hallucination? Yeah. Are you, you know, projecting this into my head? Is it, you know, and the scene, actually, I have the script here. I'll read you what he says in reply to her.
My goodness.
Hello.
Wow. Here we go.
Was that just me who dropped out there?
I don't know. I'm wondering, could somebody be – could it be a cord jiggling USB thing that if somebody – one person goes out that everybody drops out?
Well, Sam and I seem to be fairly constant.
Yeah, Paul and I seem to be sticking off this thing out. It's the Paul and Sam show apparently.
I know. Sorry. If it's me, I apologize. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. But
My plug seems to be stuck in there pretty well at this point.
That's what she said.
Yeah. I can.
That line's in the movie too. It's amazing.
I mean, I'm happy to restart my computer if you want to take the time.
Oh no,
it's okay. I think we've got about another 20 minutes or so, and I think we could wrap it in about 20. But it's been great. Go ahead. Yeah. So you were talking about the sounds your character hears.
Right, this scene, which is not in the film, but it will be included in the DVD extras. Let's see. She's asking, that wasn't a real mouse, was it? No. Am I hallucinating? Hold your hand against the window. So she goes to the window, puts her hand against it, and feels a loud thump strike it, but doesn't see anything. Okay, so I'm not hallucinating, she says. So you're making all these noises. How do you know what they're supposed to sound like? Do you use my ears to acquire data? And he says, sometimes. And she says, how exactly? And then he says, I make a disturbance to the fabric of many thicknesses, then I direct your attention to it. And she asks, how do you do that? Telepathically? And then he says, yes, but then we both must translate it into an agreed-upon physical sound. So that was how it came out in the film. But then some years later, actually, I had – not some years. I would say 2 years after the fact, I had the chance to ask what that actually was. There's an interspecies communicator named Kathleen Jones who I work with, and she sought to get some clarification for me. And so I asked the question The main thing that interested me was the pounding together of rocks, because that, you know, has been described by other people as well, and I didn't understand what it meant. So I said to them, I often felt that this person was digging under the cabin, but when I examined the ground in the morning, it would be relatively undisturbed. Can you explain to some degree how your people use telepathy to create illusions of sight and sound? And then the response was, the digging was not happening at your place. You heard it happening in another place. It is a place you do not know, but we help you to hear the sound from there. We do not have a frame around us as you humans have made for yourselves. It is open, and the sound there becomes the sound here. Here is there. We are here and we are there. We want to show you how to be here and there also. It's the same for what you see. We can be here and we can be there at the same time. So, you know.
So Tom Powell really did take part in the production. That's what you're saying. No, I'm just kidding. Tom's a fine man. He's a good. I heard The Locals is an awesome book.
It is a very good book, and his novel as well, Shady Neighbors, is a very good novel, and in fact a very cinematic novel. I hope somebody makes a movie out of it. It's quite good. I would have to say the most unusual acoustical oddity that happened to me involved one night when I was staying at a friend's guest house on her farm. Somebody was using the bathroom, you know, at about 4 a.m. I was up doing some work, and I assumed that it was the caretaker of the grounds who had come in to use the toilet. And I kind of looked over, and then they flushed and left, and I didn't see anybody leave. And I asked him the following morning, and he definitely hadn't been there. And in fact, the door was locked, and he didn't have the key to that toilet. So I later asked about that and suspected that it was, you know, this particular individual Sasquatch that was somewhat known to me from this place. And I think that was the case. So anyway, there were a lot of strange things, but that particular thing was designed to be very innocuous and sort of the sort of thing that would not scare somebody, you know. It was very humorous. I got a big kick out of it, in fact.
What are some of your or maybe just one or two of your favorite stories that you've heard Sasquatch related? Was there, when you were getting ready to write the script, were there particular alleged Bigfoot incidents that really grabbed you more than others?
Let me think. You know, I think whatever's in the movie, like in terms of his leaving behind rocks or the medicine wheel that he leaves, I mean, these are pretty common. I think they're not unique. I know Lisa Scheel in her book wrote about some of the stick signs that have been left and various other things, both in, I think, in Texas and Michigan,
I thought the Gucci bag was maybe a little bit incredulous. But anyway, I mean, it could happen. I'm sorry. But
I don't think there were really specific incidents, although I in earlier drafts of the script, when I was trying to deal with this question of, you know, the Forest Service and the extraction of Sasquatch, I tried to look at what had been written about helicopters showing up in places where people reported Sasquatch and that type of thing.
I just thought of another question from earlier in the show. I was trying to racking my brain, but I think it was about the fire lookouts. The one in particular was, and are you willing to say the name of it? Because I think I might have been to that one. It's an awesome place. Was it Snow Camp?
No, but I know where Snow Camp is. It's not far from there. I mean, there's several on that particular forest. There's Quail Prairie Mountain, Snow Camp. I forget the names of the other ones, but
yeah,
that entire region has quite a few nice, really lovely rentals.
Did you do much hiking up like around the Calmiopis Wilderness area? Did you go look around at all? And
Yes, I like it very much there. I haven't hiked all the way across it, which I would love to do. You know, and David Raines Wallace wrote about visiting, you know, Taggart's Bar along the Chetco River, way up in the headwaters of the Chetco, and that seems like a really mysterious area.
Yeah.
Really remote, and you know, unfortunately, a lot of that area is different than when he was there. Since the Biscuit Fire, it was burnt very heavily. But you know, it's something else now, and something else to explore.
That area, like you said, mystery is just a great word, I think, associated with just the general Klamath Knot area, Calmiopis as well, and not just Bigfoot related, but I was planning to go to this spot and never did, but I was curious if you had actually hiked up to the spot where and I don't know if we've ever mentioned this on the show before, but allegedly the only or one of only two places in World War II where the U.S. mainland was actually bombed by the Japanese is in the Calmiopis. Well, have you ever heard this before, Chris?
Yes, I know where you're referring to, and I've never been there myself, but I have been on the Chetco Divide Trail, which I believe is the trail you have to take in order to get down to that. And that's a lovely place. There's a scene of Sarah in the film hiking on the Chetco Divide Trail where you can see a lot of burnt trees and then the ocean, you know, in the distance. It's a dusk shot.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was actually the Japanese got, I don't know how close with a submarine. They actually, this is a true story. They had a plane that they constructed. They brought piecemeal, a tiny little plane, and it launched off the submarine, and they dropped two bombs. One of which didn't explode, and then one it was going on the theory, we're going to start this massive forest fire, and of course they underestimated the relative amount of rainfall that actually happens in the Pacific Northwest, and so the fire went out relatively quickly, and so it's actually you can hike to this area, and there is a plaque that says this is the only place where a bomb was dropped during World War II. And the kicker to the story, which I think is awesome, was years later, like 20, 30 years later, the small town of, I think it's Brookings, invited the guy who dropped the bomb to come be in a parade, you know, as just, you know, let's heal old wounds. And so the guy, first he was reluctant. He thought of maybe it was a trap or something. They were going to put him in jail. And they assured him, and he came, and he was in the parade. And if you go to, and again, I think it's Brookings, Brookings Public Library, there is a samurai sword that he brought, apparently was part of his family legacy, that he brought as a gift for them allowing him to be in this parade 30 years after he bombed the forest.
Wow. That's interesting. I never heard that part of the story.
Yeah. It's really, really cool. What if the bomb he dropped hit a Sasquatch and killed him? How weird. It's like I always said, when D.B. Cooper actually landed and when his chute didn't open and he landed on a Sasquatch, how cool would have that been?
It was summarily eaten
funny you should mention that. There is a children's – I say children's. It's a sort of teenager's book by Roland Smith where the Bigfoot hunter is D.B. Cooper. It's the book's just called Sasquatch. It's a great book. Any teenager would love it, or sort of young reader. I think I was mid 30s when I read it, and I thought it was fantastic.
Cool. Well,
I was always fond of the Bigfoot Hunter from Harry and the Hendersons.
Really supposedly based on Renee DeHinden.
Yeah.
Roughly based. The actor, was that David Suchet, I think?
Yes.
The English actor.
Yeah.
I think he also played Edward Teller.
Smell the hair and go after him. The BBC's then magically at the end of the film, series. He loves them the dearly. Actor. You know, that was Spielberg. Come on.
Here we go. And it's Paul and I again.
Good Lord.
You know, it's actually good that this is happening because if our regular
Hello?
Listeners were to tune in and Uh-oh. Not hear technical
hear
difficulty,
wow.
they would think they were listening to the wrong show.
Yeah.
Hello?
Sorry,
Hello. We're doing this on purpose, of course, to make sure that we really suck. Brian,
this is the Bigfoot Show's version of hazing, Chris. Okay, just so you know, that this is how we haze the new people.
Hi.
Yeah, this is truly this is like, wow.
Oh, I'm sorry if it's my computer that's doing it.
I don't think so. It was just a guess.
We think it's Scott's computer.
Well, it could. Yeah. Paul and I are throwing Scott under the bus.
Exactly.
I know my computer is kind of old, so it could be that.
Yeah, but Scott's kind of old too. So
hey, come on now.
53.
Come on. Am I on the only Mac here? Wait, Chris strikes me as a Mac user.
Yeah, I'm on a Mac too. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's two Macs, and I'm guessing. Well, Paul has said he had a PC, and I'm going to guess Sam's got a PC.
I've got a cup and string.
Well, I have
lost him.
Yeah, I mean, I have a Mac as well. But the last time I tried using the Mac, it was really echoey.
Wow.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah.
Did we lose Scott again?
Oh, we've just lost Scott. That's okay. Yeah. We've got Chris still. That's fine.
Wow.
Chris is more important than Scott.
I think Paul is actually trying to get me off the show. I think that's what's going on. Anyway, go ahead.
I'd never do that.
Well, is I don't know. Are we done? I mean, I know we usually go 2 hours, but
yeah, no, I think we're just about done. I think all I'll say is that I'm always hesitant. I've watched an awful lot of quote unquote Bigfoot movies over the years, a heck of a lot of them, more than is healthy. So I approach every single one with this slight feeling of dread. The sort of feeling of dread that you get every time you watch Finding Bigfoot and the credits roll. And I've got to say, I'm not just saying this because Chris is on and we're sort of sucking up to him a bit, but it was a really good movie. I really enjoyed watching it, and I never expect to enjoy watching a so-called Bigfoot movie. But it was, I mean, the fact that you did this on a really tight budget isn't noticeable. The camera work and the editing is every bit as professional as you'd find in a Hollywood movie.
Well, thank you. I mean, I have my colleagues to thank for that. The cinematographer, Rob Sweeney, and the editor, Curtis Clayton.
We didn't think you'd been responsible for it.
Exactly, yeah. No, but thank you for saying so.
It is very good. I mean, you wouldn't – when you look at some of the Bigfoot movies that we've seen over the last few years, and I'm not going to name any names, but some of them look as if somebody's gone out with a $200 camcorder. This is a really nice and well filmed and edited movie, and I think we ought to plug it one last time. That it is 14 days left to fund this through Kickstarter.
To fund the home video release.
Yeah, I think what you should have done is actually filmed the first 1 hour 20 minutes of the movie. And then stopped dead and said, I'm not doing the last 10 minutes.
Without your $25.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of filmmakers now are using crowdfunding to actually, you know, finance the shooting itself. I did this film, it wasn't as common, though. I think crowdfunding was just sort of getting going at that point.
Sure, and this is the first time I've seen a crowdfunding for the purpose of home distribution. Why? I mean, obviously, you wanted to get this distributed. You wanted to get it out on DVD, and presumably, there's going to be some sort of pay-per-view option or streaming option at some point. But what made you decide, let's give this a go?
Well, there weren't really any other options, so that was the reason.
And I think we're going to see more films like this too, because you know, and it always usually takes somebody to take that step. Look, okay, let's make a film that it's not a goofy Bigfoot. And you know, again, I'm sure that had a lot to do with why it was tough to get funding originally. But my hope is that when that probably happens in the future, whether through Chris's potential sequel or other filmmakers, that that this film will be remembered. And so I think there's a pretty good chance it has legs for the future, or feet, as it were, because, you know, it is a good film, and it hopefully will be remembered for taking that step.
Yeah, thank you. It's not often you see a film like this that's been funded on such a tiny budget to look at it, you know, to watch the film all the way through and think, yeah, I'm really pleased I saw that. And I feel I've got to thank you, Chris, for letting us see these screener copies of it in advance, because way to describe it?
It's really great.
We've all read good things about the movie, but to actually see it was a real privilege from my point of view.
Oh well, no, I certainly wouldn't. It's always, you know, to talk about the film with you, you would have had to have seen it. So thank you for watching.
So now that I've seen it, can I take me $25 back off Kickstarter?
Sure. <that's...
laughs> And for those, whenever they are listening, whenever you're hearing this show, the specific date that the project ends, or the funding for the project ends at Kickstarter, is April 1st at 5:12 p.m. So make sure before that time, if you're interested in this, go there. And again, he's got several options. I mean, I did the $25 one as well. That's great. You get the DVD. It's got the bonus scenes. But he's got the $50 option as well, that gives you the DVD plus music from the film, a CD from The Edge of the World by renowned folk early music band Ensemble Galalelele. I know I didn't pronounce that right. But also other tiers, $75, $100, $200 or more. So
I like the $75 one where for $75 you not only get a copy of the movie, but Chris comes and washes your car every week for a
month. That's amazing. And the $100 pledge, where Jack Lapsaritis shows you video of Sasquatches having psychic sex, which I think is amazing. Nobody else is offering.
The $50 one really is a great one, because it does have a really great musical score.
I've got to say, having listened to it, I am very tempted to change to the $50 pledge.
Well, I feel really fortunate to have, you know, Ensemble Galilee in the film. They're just a wonderful group, and so good with their instruments. I feel really fortunate. They had actually put out an album of music from Shakespeare's time a number of years ago, and I had been listening to it while preparing the film. And originally, the subplot involving actor playing the Tempest, or sorry, playing Caliban in the Tempest was a bigger one. And that's sort of where that style of music came from, you know, for the movie.
Hey, Chris, I had a quick question. The name of the actor, he only has a couple scenes, but anybody who sees the film will immediately recognize him, because he's one of those guys, he's been in a lot of stuff, and he's really good. He always plays he's a pretty good heavy, you know, is the gentleman who represents, I forgot, does he represent the lumber service, or either the Forest Service or the log gang, getting mixed up when they had that little meeting?
Right, Don McManus.
Don McManus, man, he is so just good, because he is kind of, you know, he's kind of the bad guy, but I like the way you wrote it. You shaded characters not to be, you know, too good, too bad. And for those, Don McManus, by the way, folks, for Seinfeld fans, was the guy Jerry challenged. Remember, he was going to race the old buddy of his in the street and to see if he was faster. And that famous episode of Seinfeld, that's the guy, and he's in it. He's great. The guy who's the logger is great. What's his name? I've seen him in other stuff too.
Jim Cody Williams. Yeah, another really solid character actor.
Yeah. So, these aren't just guys, you know, he found down at the college. He's just like some really good actors in this film as well. Maybe he did find guys down at the college too, because, you know, you got to find them where you can get them. But, man. Hey, this has been great, Chris, having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, it's a pleasure. Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's really nice to interact with you guys and to hear, you know, what you felt, being people who are very knowledgeable about this subject, to hear your thoughts on it. So I do appreciate that a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We appreciate being referred to as knowledgeable.
Yeah, in a field where there's very little.
I just appreciate being referred to as people.
And Chris, definitely keep us posted. If we'll post updates on the Bigfoot Show page at Facebook. But beyond this, if you obviously start leaning toward possibly working on a sequel, we'd love to hear about it.
Of course, yeah, no, absolutely. I would love to keep everybody abreast of any plans in that area.
Yeah. We presume that everybody that listens to this goes to the Bigfoot Show Facebook page, but if not, go there and there's links there to the Kickstarter page for the movie. Otherwise, go to Kickstarter.com and search for Letters from the Big Man. It's as easy as that.
Yep.
And you got to April the 1st.
And there's 139 backers so far. Again, he still needs about 2,000, and April 1st is the deadline, so do it immediately after the show ends.
Otherwise,
pause it right now.
Yeah.
Go there, put down $50 for the music, make me a copy, and then send it to me. And then, no. But it would be really nice to see Chris reach his goal and be able to get this out in DVD as soon as he can.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
If you don't, you're letting everybody down.
Yeah.
Well, I realize that. It's been, certainly been hanging over me. So just the sense that I mentioned earlier of the audience really wanting a film like this to be distributed. So
yeah, I mean it's interesting. We've seen other films that we've sort of heard of and heard great things about, and they never ever see the light of day.
Oh really?
And I honestly thought this film was going to go the same way. It was going to be one of those movies that we never got to see. So to actually be able to you know push it or help it get released, I think is really good. I mean, it's a fantastic feeling from my point of view to be able to do something to contribute to actually getting to see the movie. I'm sure there are other movies that if they'd gone down this road, that have been the distribution would have been funded.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Oh, hello. Did you lose me?
I can still hear you.
I'm all alone again.
Jeez.
Well, yeah, I would just add, and we did lose Scott.
Sorry. Wow.
I know he's
so
back.
Funny. I just keep talking. It keeps recording here. It just sounds like I'm a very sad man.
Well, before one of us permanently falls into the vortex, I would just add on to what Paul was saying. You know, in this field, that it can also, you know, often be divisive and, contentious. This is a rare opportunity for everyone who is a Bigfoot enthusiast, regardless of where you fall on the subject, to come together and support something that really deserves to be supported and that will be good for everybody. I mean, you know, this is an opportunity for us all to kick a little in and see a good movie get the distribution that it deserves.
Yeah, that would be great. We've just lost Scott again, so we probably ought to just wrap up.
He didn't need to hear that anyway.
Did we all get lost? It's so many.
It's just you,
shit
Scott.
His pants. When he tries to edit this, he's going to go, what the hell? So, anyway. All right. Is this our final wrap up?
Final.
Probably best at this point.
Yes. All right, Chris.
Okay, well, thank you again, you guys.
All right. And, keep us posted. And thanks again.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
And scene.